I'm going to talk about two big trends in American life over the last 50 or 60 years, the decline of institutional Christianity and the growing polarization of our politics.
Ross Douthat of the New York Times talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The increasingly strident division between an ideological left and an ideological right. And I'm going to argue that Christianity has weakened precisely because people have become more likely to identify with ideologies than with religious beliefs, and that a recovered Christianity, a more robust public religious faith, is actually an answer to polarization because it gives people an identity that's bigger than partisanship, so they can define themselves as Christians first and liberals or conservatives second.
You can meet and hear Ross Douthat at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here with leaders from across the country and all around the world who are all united by a shared belief in the glory of God and the power of prayer.
I believe that God is love, which is more accurate than saying that love is God. God is the epitome of love. He defines what love is.
No, not so, dear brother. I did not point you down that path so that baptism should grant the liberty to sin. Quite the opposite.
To stray from God's created order and God's created design then becomes a direct attack on the triune God of love in whose image we are made.
Southern Illinois bird watchers love Issues Etc.
I have not seen this kind of attention paid to an abortion law in a long time. There are incremental laws being passed all the time in the states that restrict abortion to one degree or another, that chip away at the edges of Roe v. Wade. Well, this didn't chip away at the edges. This simply said no more abortion in our state, effectively. Alabama passed a new abortion law, and it has the abortion rights advocates essentially declaring doomsday, and it has pro-lifers heartened and buoyed by that news. There are some critics, though. There are some who are saying it's not the right time. It's not the right law. And do we really want to send this kind of law inevitably to the U.S. Supreme Court? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live on this Thursday afternoon, the 16th of May. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. David French of National Review is joining us here in the first few minutes of the program to talk about Alabama's new abortion law. A little bit later, we'll stay on the same subject. There has been some criticism of Alabama's new abortion law from Pat Robertson. Terry Mattingly will join us to talk about media coverage of that criticism. Suzanne Venker joins us a little bit after that. We'll talk women, men, and sex. She says that women are trying to have sex like men, and it's hurting them. And then Pastor Chris Roseborough will join us for This Week in Pop Christianity. A Trump Cyrus gold coin is being offered by Jim Baker and Lance Wallnau. We'll find out why they're offering it, what they're promising for it, and what you'll have to pay, not only in terms of your money, but in terms perhaps of your eternal salvation if you believe their false promises. Joining us to talk about Alabama's new abortion law, David French. He's a regular guest, a constitutional law attorney, previously served as senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice and for Alliance Defending Freedom. He's senior writer for National Review and author of a recent column there titled, Alabama and Georgia Are Throwing Down the Gauntlet Against Roe. Good. David, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I want you to make the bigger point that you have recently made and you've been making for some time so we can understand why it is you argue the way you do about the Georgia and the Alabama laws. The bigger point being that Roe has broken or maybe even badly hurt the American Republic. How is that?
Yeah, so you've taken probably the most emotional and contentious American public policy debate since certainly, say, Jim Crow, and arguably since slavery. And then the Supreme Court, through Roe v. Wade, has almost entirely removed it from the actual democratic process of the United States without any provision in the Constitution specifically dealing with abortion. This was a
unilateral judicial act. So here you have the most contentious issue in all of American politics. And the only way you can truly, substantially, or even really, truly indirectly materially impact the debate is by voting for a president who then selects Supreme Court justices. That's it. That's how you can do it. Now, you can vote for state legislators and governors who will sign into law modest abortion restrictions, things that kind of nibble around the edges of the abortion right. But to fundamentally, truly impact the debate, the only way to do it is these presidential elections, which has escalated the intensity and the emotion around national politics for a generation without actually providing any sort of real resolution on the issue. And so that's how Roe v. Wade helped break American politics.
So in that vein, tell us the substance of, in particular, the Alabama law that everyone's talking about right now, and also the Georgia law.
Yeah, so essentially what both Alabama and Georgia are doing is they have passed laws that don't nibble around the edges of Roe, but they are directly and fundamentally incompatible with Roe. Georgia was probably the strictest abortion law in the nation when it was signed last week by the Georgia governor. What it did is it declared the personhood of the unborn child, and it declared that there can be no abortion once there's a discernible human heartbeat. So it was a classic heartbeat bill with a addition of a personhood provision. Alabama went further and just basically, with very, very limited exceptions, just banned abortion outright. From the moment when a person knows they're pregnant, they cannot get an abortion. And they controversially did not include exceptions for rape or incest, and they did also include a personhood provision.
Why is that personhood provision so important as a legal response to the reasoning of Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. So I talked to the drafter of the Georgia bill, and he reminded me of a segment of the Roe v. Wade opinion, which was in Part 9 of the Roe v. Wade opinion. And in Part 9 of the opinion, Justice Blackmun says, if a fetus is a person constitutionally, then the reasoning in support of abortion collapses. And that's the word he uses, is collapse. And so essentially, one of the arguments around abortion, in addition to sort of arguing that it should be left to the states because the Constitution is silent about abortion rights, there was also an argument that, well, wait a minute, a unborn child is a person, and you cannot deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And so what these states do is they said, look, we know that we cannot change the federal constitutional definition of personhood, but we can adjust our state definition of personhood. And so what we would do, and we're going to expand the liberty of the unborn child by granting them personhood status. And so then when we go back to the federal courts, we'll say, we have, in our state, have granted this expanded protection and this expanded definition of personhood, and therefore the case for Roe collapses when the baby is identified as a natural person. Now, look, I mean, the Supreme Court doesn't have to buy that reasoning. The Supreme Court could reject that reasoning. But I do believe it's a intellectually, philosophically, and legally consistent way, morally as well, consistent way of describing an unborn child.
Critics are going after these laws because they believe they overreach. I mean, I'm talking about pro-life critics.
Sure.
And they're saying, look, they're asking for too much too soon, and we don't necessarily want to bring this in front of the Supreme Court. These laws will certainly be challenged in the courts, and it could get the court to reaffirm Roe. What are your thoughts there, David?
Well, a couple of things. One, if all you ever send the Supreme Court are cases that nibble around the edges of Roe or Planned Parenthood v. Casey, then you actually cannot expect the court to rule one way or the other on Roe. Because it's a sort of an old axiom judicial philosophy that says you do not make rulings that are broader than necessary. Okay, so if I seek to uphold an admitting privileges law, let's say the one from Louisiana that's being challenged in court, and I go to the court and I say, I want you to uphold the admittings privileges law, and I want you to overturn Roe. The justices will look at you and say, what does overturning Roe have to do with the admitting privileges law? I could rule for or against the admitting privileges law without touching Roe, without touching Planned Parenthood v. Casey, because Casey says that state laws cannot put an undue burden on the abortion right. And all I have to do is rule that an admitting privileges law is not an undue burden. So Roe's intact, Casey's intact, and you get your admitting privileges law. So all of these incremental laws, I think it's unlikely that the court would use any one of them to fundamentally reevaluate Roe. So what would cause them to fundamentally reevaluate Roe? Well, a law that's fundamentally incompatible with Roe. Now, they may not take it. They may not take up these cases. They may not take up a one. They may all die in federal court in the lower courts. But if the Supreme Court, in the face of state after state after state, representing collectively tens of millions of people, and many of them passing these laws with supermajorities in their state houses and senates, if the Supreme Court just refuses to look at them, that's instructive. That tells us that Roe is not in any danger. In spite of all these won presidential elections, in spite of all these judicial nomination fights, and we kind of need to know where the current court stands on Roe, and this is one way to try to find out.
How would you counsel someone who says, you know, what you've set up here is really a way of testing to see if we've been, you use the analogy, we've been Charlie Brown to Lucy's football invitation when it comes to our pro-life politicians?
Right. I mean, that's, you know, this is one, again, one thing that I'm trying to urge that we clarify is we have been through these judicial nomination wars. We have fought hard over these judicial nominees with the understanding and belief that they will uphold the original intent and the original understanding, public meaning of the Constitution of the United States. There isn't a coherent originalist case for Roe v. Wade at all or in any way, shape, or form. And so it's important for us to understand where these guys actually are intellectually, where they are judicially. We need to know where they are. Otherwise, we're going to just keep repeating the same cycle where, you know, we'll even stomach and vote for terrible candidates because, well, the judges, we got to know about the judges. Well, if the judges don't come through, we got to rethink all of this. And so I think it's important to know this. And it's also important that the timing now, because for the first time in a generation, Justice Kennedy is not on the court. And we knew Justice Kennedy's views on abortion. We knew where a majority of the court stood. The best we were going to hope for was tiny, tiny incremental changes in abortion law. Well, now it's a different court. We don't know where they're going to stand on these things. We don't know what they're willing to do. And in the face of that uncertainty, I say, let's challenge them.
I'm curious about the timing here. Why do you argue that this is, all other things being equal, the timing is right for something like the Georgia law or the Alabama law?
Well, there's two reasons. One, the pro-life movement has progressed to a point where a critical mass of pro-life, grassroots pro-life folks, are no longer content with nibbling around the edges. They are ready to throw down the gauntlet. They're ready to make the legal and moral declaration that their state should be either entirely or mostly abortion-free. And so you have an enormous amount of energy as a result of decades of pro-life activism that is finding its expression in these laws. And then number two, the court has changed, and we have no guarantee, zero, none, nada, that it will substantially change in our favor one iota at any point over, say, the next 20 years. And so to say, the court has changed, but I'm going to wait to challenge Roe until the court has changed more in our favor, is you're waiting for something you have zero certainty of it happening. If Trump wins re-election, or if a justice retires or passes away between now and the 2020 election, then perhaps the composition ideologically will change. But we just don't know, but we do know that it has changed as of now. And we do know that there is a possibility, I'm not optimistic enough to say a probability, but I'll say there's a possibility that we could call into question the Roe precedent. And there is no certainty that this state of affairs will exist or be better now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now.
You also say that moral declarations have their own value. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that when you're talking about a fundamental moral issue, it's scientific, but it's also moral. We can't ignore either side of that coin. When you're talking about a moral value, I think it is important for communities to declare what their values are, to say this injustice is occurring over our objection, not in our name. We aspire to and desire something better. And what is fascinating to me is it appears as if, in spite of the backlash you see online, each of these heartbeat bills is spurring another, and they're incentivizing other states to come alongside their sister states. So we're about to reach a point where if you count heartbeat bills, Alabama's bill, or trigger bills, those bills that would ban abortion in the event Roe is overturned, you're beginning to look at a really big, geographically contiguous swath of the United States is saying, not in our name. And I think that's important for the Supreme Court to see. I think that's important for America's cultural leaders and cultural influencers to see the power and strength of the pro-life movement.
I'm calling this time between the shift in the court and whatever happens next, I've been searching for this, David, the pre-possibly post-Roe preview, that we're getting to see where the actual battle lines post-Roe might fall, and we're getting to see on both sides the legislative plans. What are your thoughts there?
I think that's fair. I think what you're seeing is a prepping the battlefield for the possibility of a fundamental change in Roe. And you're seeing it in the states. I mean, look, in New York, everyone, is pulling the spotlight on Alabama for its alleged extremism. Well, let's not forget the extremism we've seen in New York, for example, where its legislature passed with huge majorities an extreme pro-choice bill. So you're beginning to see how federalism is working itself out here, that different states are passing different laws that embody the different values of those different states. And so I think you're seeing a lot of prepping the battlefield for a legal change that may never come. But again, we need to find out if it will.
Finally, then, do you think that the court, when these things are challenged, will take up either of these laws when challenged in the federal courts?
That's a great question. Let me put it this way. The more states that pass these laws, and I believe the greater chance the court will take them, take one of them at least, because the court is keenly aware of issues that are of extreme political importance. So it handled the Trump travel ban case on a pretty much expedited basis because of the importance. It took up the census case on an expedited basis because of legal deadlines and because of the importance of the case. It is well aware of cases that are of extreme importance to the American public. And so if you have just one heartbeat bill, if you have two, if you even have just three, I think the odds that the court would take one of them to have that white hot intensity placed on it to see if it was going to overturn Roe, it's pretty low. But if it becomes five states, six states, seven states, eight states, nine, 10 more states, then what you'll see is I think the court would begin to feel an imperative to weigh in, because it's dealing with the expressed wishes of tens of millions of Americans on a fundamental constitutional issue. So I think the more of these that are passed, the greater likelihood the court takes it up.
David French is a constitutional law attorney. He previously served as senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice and for the Alliance Defending Freedom. He's senior writer at National Review and author of a recent column titled "Alabama and Georgia Are Throwing Down the Gauntlet Against Roe." Good. You can read it for yourself at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. David, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
When we come back, Terry Mattingly joins us. We're going to spend some time talking with him about media coverage of Pat Robertson's criticism of Alabama's new abortion law and why the press refers to Pat Robertson as a televangelist when Terry says technically he isn't. We'll be right back.
Why the Public Square Needs Christianity, Progressivism, Joyfully Lutheran, Planned Parenthood, The Lord's Supper, The Hippocratic Oath, Lutheran Education, Christian Hope. Some of your favorite guests will address these topics at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. The one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.